Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the third chapter of the second book, and this is the sixth part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Book 2, Chapter 3, With the Indians. We had been with our host nearly a week when I said to my mate, "Look here, Luxton, we have a long way to go yet, so we had better make another start." But Luxton was anxious to get some Indian curios before we sailed. Mac said, "Stop till tomorrow, for it's the Sabbath and we'll go to church." So we decided to stay, on my part chiefly because I thought Mac had a little religious feeling in him and therefore would like our company to church. The place was crowded with men and women, both old and young. The missionary was an Englishman and an earnest good man who tried his very best to make the locals understand. Unfortunately, he was not very well versed in their language, and as they did not understand much English, he was obliged to mix the two a little to make himself understood. During this particular morning, he was trying to explain what a sinner was, which he found it very difficult to do. All at once, the old woman, whom Mac had called an old hag the day before, got up from the very front bench and, without saying a word, came down to where we were sitting. Pointing her finger at Mackenzie, she looked at the missionary and said, "That is one." Mac was one of those long-whiskered old Scotchmen and very good-natured. All he said was, "I will get even with her the next time she wants to buy a new dress." The bad weather returned for a few days. The wind was in the southwest, and we were therefore obliged to wait a little longer for better weather. One day I stopped on board to do a little work that had to be done, and my mate went out hunting, returning a little after dark with a bag full of birds. After we'd finished our supper, he said to me confidentially, "Say, John, I have made some great discoveries today. I found a place where we can get a boatload of all kinds of Indian curios, the best in the land, but we must keep it from old Mac, as he would not like it." "Where is it?" I asked, "and why wouldn't Mac like us to get them?" Because it's an Indian graveyard, and we will have to go there at night." Well, I wanted some curios myself, but to rob a graveyard at night? Why, it gave me the shivers just to think of it. Next morning we went out hunting, and after a little while reached the graveyard. Instead of traditional Western graves, the dead bodies had been put in all kinds of old boxes and left above the ground. Some of them were even placed in the tops of trees, and all kinds of Indian tools, baskets, spears, old guns, mats, etc. were piled upon the coffins. On and around one I counted 15 bags of flour. I found out later that it was a custom among the Indians when one of them dies that most, if not all, of his belongings go with the body to the graveyard. There was one large cave leading from a gravel beach about 400 feet into a small mountain, apparently washed in years ago by large seas coming in from the Pacific Ocean. But at the time of my visit, the cave was quite an appreciable height above the high water mark. The mouth of this cave must have been about 40 feet in diameter, the shape nearly round, and getting gradually smaller and smaller from the mouth. My mate and I walked up to the innermost end. It was as dark as night, and we were obliged to strike a match to see. There we found dead bodies all wrapped up in some kind of native blanket. In some of the blankets, nothing was left but human bones. Mac helped himself to some of the skulls, which he was destined, however, to leave behind on his way out, for when we got to the entrance of the cave, we saw some Indians outside, apparently waiting for us to come out. As they were armed, Mac dropped the skulls and walked out to meet them. They appeared to be very angry with us for going into the cave, but upon our assuring them that we did not know of the cemetery inside the cave, they let us off with a warning. We also became acquainted with the Indian chief, who invited us to come with him in his canoe on the next calm day to catch a whale. Hunting whales in a canoe was something I'd never seen before, so I accepted the chief's invitation. But as it could only be done on a calm day, we were obliged to wait some time before the weather was fine. Three canoes were got ready one afternoon. The Indians put on board each canoe whale spears, long lines and large sea lions' bladders, together with some provisions and blankets, and the next morning at 1 o'clock we started off with three men in each canoe, except the one I was in, which had four. Of course, I was only a passenger. The distance from Dodgers Cove to the ocean is only a few miles, but we went about 10 miles off the coast before we sighted a whale, and a big one at that. The three canoes went along abreast, about 500 yards apart. I was in the middle one. The canoe on our right sighted the whale, and after giving the signal, all three rushed after the monster. It was some time before we got near him. The canoe on my left got in the first and only spear, but was apparently too near when the harpoon struck. The whale gave just one slap with his tail, which smashed the canoe to pieces. The three men swam for their dear lives, while the whale, with the harpoon inside him, rushed along at full speed. A long line was fastened to the spear, to which were attached three sea lion bladders, and as these floated on the surface, we could see the direction he took. After picking up the three Indians, we went after him, but it seems that the whale got too much of a start, and we lost sight of the bladders and never saw the whale again. We then returned to get another canoe. As the weather kept calm, we went out again the next morning, this time with better success. We were only about 5 miles off the coast when we sighted two large whales, and in a very short time one of the canoes was fast to one of them. The whale travelled so rapidly that the Indians had to let him go with the line and bladders, after which all three canoes put after him, following the bladders, which were sometimes on top of the water and sometimes lost to view, though only just for a second, when he would come up again. After the whale had gone quite a distance with the heavy drag of the bladders behind him, he slackened his speed and the canoes gradually came up with him. They then drove two more spears into his body, which urged him to make another start. But the canoes stuck to him, and the Indians, continually throwing spears, soon had him conquered. It seemed to me as if the sea monster knew that he had lost the battle, as he gradually came under the control of the Indians. With one canoe on each side of him and one behind, they led him along under his own power towards a sand beach near Dodge's Cove, where they wished to cut him up. When we got about a mile from the beach, the whale gradually stopped headway. The chief told me that he was dying. The Indians then fastened all the bladders onto the whale to stop him from sinking, after which the three canoes got ahead of him and towed him in. He was then placed on the sand beach at high tide, and when the tide was low and the whale high and dry, nearly all the natives from Dodge's Cove, old and young, cut him up, after which the Indians held a great feast where the whale meat was equally divided among all the inhabitants. The chief gave me a piece of the whale meat, which I cut up in strips and fried, and it turned out to be an excellent steak. Chapter 4. Into the Wide Pacific, Sea-Going Qualities of the Tilikum. Between Old Mac, the Indians, fishing, war dances, canoe racing, and our own hunting and fishing, it was made so pleasant for us that we stopped at Dodge's Cove till July the 6th. Of course, everything had been ready for sea for some time, and both of us slept on board that night. I got up early next morning and found the weather was fine, with a gentle breeze blowing off the land. I said to my mate, "All hands on deck, heave up anchor and set sail," and in a few minutes we were under all sail and heading out towards the ocean. The light wind, which was from the northeast, gradually hauled into the northwest, increasing as we got further off the land. We shaped our course to the south, as our plan was to cross the equator in 125 degrees west longitude and make the Marquesas Islands our first place of call. During the middle part of the day, we had a fresh northwesterly breeze, and at 3 o'clock, when the mountain tops on Vancouver Island sank very low, I was sitting in the cockpit steering when I saw, quite a long way from us, a splash of water thrown up in the air. I kept watching that place for a little while, and then saw that it was a whale spouting. I knew from former experience that that part of the ocean was full of whales, but as my mate had never seen one spouting and was at that time down in the cabin making afternoon tea, I called him up to have a look at the sight. While both of us were watching the whale, we noticed that he was coming towards us and every few minutes throwing more than half of his large body out of the water and then falling back down, which latter caused the splash. The big sea monster came nearer and nearer to us, and we soon discovered that he was trying to get away from the killers, which are the worst enemy of the whale. The whale was doing his best to get away, swinging his large flippers about, his only means of defence, but whenever he came to the surface, the killers, sometimes as many as half a dozen, would jump on top of him, while others underneath ripped him up with their large fins. It was a battle for life, but we could see plainly that the whale, large as he was, weakened fast from the awful punishment his enemies inflicted upon him. The last time the combatants showed themselves, they were only about 100 yards from us, and as we had our rifles all ready, we fired a few shots among them, after which they all disappeared. The weather kept fine and clear all day, and with a fresh breeze the Tilikum went along like a little ship. That night before dark we lost sight of land, which we did not see again for 58 days. We were now in the open ocean, and running into harbour for the night or tying the Tilikum to a tree was out of the question. We were now obliged to stay at sea by night as well as by day and take the bitter with the sweet. Not only that, we also had to keep under sail and steer the boat on her course, as we had a straight course of at least 4,000 miles to travel before seeing land again, and to make 4,000 miles on the ocean in a small boat, a man must keep his eyes open. Therefore, the very first thing which I had to teach my companion was how to look after the Tilikum while I slept. My mate was a man of good common sense, and as the weather kept fine for several days, I had no trouble in teaching him enough seamanship to take care of the Tilikum at night as well as day. From that time, we took turn about turn, and we also regulated our meal hours as follows. Breakfast at 7 o'clock, which consisted of porridge and condensed milk, sometimes boiled eggs with coffee and hard tack. Dinner at noon, at which we generally had boiled potatoes, tinned meat of different kinds, coffee and hard tack and butter. And for supper, at 6 o'clock, we generally made some kind of stew from what was left over from dinner, finishing up with tea, hard tack and butter. The above is not much of a daily bill of fare, but we got along fine with it and always kept in good condition. In cooking, we also took turns. The weather kept fine and the northwest wind moderated until July the 11th, when it started to increase during the morning hours, accompanied by heavy passing clouds from the northwest. At noon, the Tilikum was going along at her very best speed under all sail. The seas began to get larger, and at times some of the tops would come over just enough to give us a good soaking. As the wind and sea kept on increasing, I took in the mainsail and spanker, and under the foresail, the Tilikum went along very nicely. Still, the wind kept on increasing, and at 3 o'clock in the afternoon it was blowing very hard, the seas getting dangerous for a small boat. I thought it best to heave to in time, which would simultaneously give me a chance to experiment with the boat to find out under what sails she would lay head to sea the best. In preparing to bring the boat round head to sea, I first of all lowered all sail to make her go as slow as possible before the wind. I then told my mate to go forward, hold on to the foremast and stand by to drop the sea anchor overboard when I said the word. To my great surprise, he refused to do this, telling me that he would not do it for his grandmother. The Tilikum was going along under bare poles before the wind and sea, quite comfortably, now and then taking a little spray over, and as there was no particular hurry to heave to, I called to him to come out in the cockpit and sit down alongside me while I gave him a little advice. But instead of coming out as I asked him, he just put his head out of the cabin door and listened to what I had to say. "Look here, Norman," I said, "I want to give you a little explanation of the danger of running before a breaking sea. Many large vessels are sent to the bottom with one breaking sea by keeping the vessel running before a gale too long, and where would the Tilikum and you and I be if we were to let her run before a heavy gale? This is not a heavy gale yet, but it will be by tonight, and therefore we must put our boat in safety before the seas get too large. Is it not much better and safer to let the boat run along with the seas? She will then go nearly as fast as the waves, and I should think, therefore, that the seas would have no power on her, and the boat would be much safer," my mate replied. "It probably looks that way to you, but the reverse is the case. To begin with, waves, which seamen generally call seas, in a gale run at a speed of about 27 to 28 miles an hour. Our boat, at the very best, can only make 8 miles an hour, and the 8 miles are mostly made when she is on top of the seas, because when the boat is between the seas, the wind blows over her, and she consequently loses headway. As long as there is no break on the seas, we are quite safe in letting her go as fast as she likes, but when the seas are breaking, we run a great risk by allowing the boat to run before it. The seas are starting to break now, so we must prepare to heave to." I fail to see the point yet, my mate contended, as to why a boat should be safer with her headway stopped than when she is sailing along with the sea and the wind. Look here, Norman, I replied, I should like that you be perfectly satisfied on this point, for then I know you will have more confidence in our boat. I will therefore explain to you where the danger comes in with running before breaking seas. When a vessel runs before breaking seas, her stern is pulled down by suction of the water, and the faster she sails, the greater is the suction in this case, and when a breaking sea overtakes the boat and her stern is held down by suction, the breaker will go over the top of her with tremendous force. One breaking sea of that kind may send a large vessel to the bottom. On the other hand, if the broken sea runs under her stern, then the bow will be way down and the stern high up, and the rudder will have no control over the vessel. She will then come round sideways, and the same breaker will most likely turn her bottom upwards. But if a boat or a ship in a heavy gale is stopped from going ahead through the water, she is free from suction, and consequently will rise even to a breaking sea. It matters very little whether a vessel lays head on, stern on, or sidewards, as long as her headway is stopped. There is only one way of stopping a sailing vessel from going ahead in a heavy gale, and that is to bring her head to the wind and sea, and this is called heaving to. Large sailing vessels hove to under storm sails and properly loaded as a rule lie very dry and comfortable. They may take quite a lot of water on board during a heavy gale, but water in a case of this kind just rolls over the rails and is harmless. If she does ship dangerous seas when hove to, it is a sure sign that the vessel is carrying too much sail. Now, in our case with our small vessel, and only a 3/4-inch cedar deck, we cannot allow even one sea to board us, as one sea breaking over this vessel will most likely put us out of business. Therefore, to keep seas from breaking over us, we must, first of all, heave to in time, and heave her to in such a way that she will not ship heavy water even in the worst gale. And that is what we are going to do right now. You understand me now, don't you? My mate looked at me, and then at the waves, and I know he was wishing himself ashore. I then tied a lifeline round his waist and told him to go forward and stand by to drop the sea anchor over the bow when I gave the word. This time he obeyed my orders, as I assured him that I would pull him in again if he should get washed overboard. He managed to get forward on his hands and knees, and when forward, held on to the foremast to wait for orders. By this time there was quite a large sea running, and some of the waves were breaking heavily. I waited for a fairly smooth sea to come along, and when she got on top I put the helm down, and as she came round inside of a few seconds, and just before swinging head to sea, I pulled the small sail down, which I had set for that occasion. When the boat got head to sea, a breaker came up in front of her, which for a few moments looked very much like a brick wall. I shouted at the top of my voice, "Throw the sea anchor over!" But instead of doing this, he dropped it on deck and climbed up the foremast, and owing to the smallness of the boat, his weight on top of the mast almost caused her to turn over. I quickly took a pull on the lifeline and told him to come down, and as the sea had passed the boat by that time, he came down just about as quickly as he went up. After throwing the sea anchor over, the Tillicum drifted along with the wind and sea and soon tightened the anchor rope. Then the boat lay about 5 points from the wind, and considering the sea which was running at the time was fairly comfortable and apparently out of danger. I thought that she would be more comfortable and safer if I could manage to get her to lay closer to the wind. I therefore set my leg of mutton spanker and hauled the sheet in flat, which made a riding sail instead of a driving sail out of it. No sooner was the sail set than she swung her head to the wind and seas to about 2.5 points. The Tillicum certainly rode fine that way. I then said to my mate, "The Tillicum is all right now, and we are as safe here as in the Victoria Hotel in Victoria, BC. Now, tell me, why did you climb the foremast instead of attending to the sea anchor when I asked you?" "Well," Luxton replied, "when I saw that sea coming up in front of us, I was certain it was coming clean on top of us." During the afternoon, while running before the strong wind and large seas, the boat had taken some spray over, and both my mate and myself got pretty wet. In fact, we were soaked to the skin, and now that she was hove to and the decks, with the exception of the forward end, were quite dry, we then changed our clothes, had our supper, and then both of us sat down in the cockpit to have a smoke and talk about the poor people on shore, who at that very moment may have trees and houses blown about their heads. The wind and sea was increasing fast towards evening, but the bow of the Tilikum rose finely to every one of the seas. "By Jove, John," said Luxton, at the same time tapping me on the shoulder, "I thought sure it was all off with us when we hove to and I saw that big sea in front of us. But to see this little canoe going over the top of those big monsters without rolling or tumbling about is most wonderful. Well, if we ever do get back to land, when I publish our experiences in this gale, not one person in 100 will believe my story." I may say that my mate, a young man, had never seen salt water until we went out in the Tilikum. Nevertheless, he proved himself a first-class shipmate in every way. Good sailor, good cook, and quick of action, but he acknowledges himself that the quickest move he ever made was in going up that mast. At dark, I put a light on deck, and one of us laid down in the bunk and the other one on the seat. The little vessel laid very comfortably during that heavy gale, in fact, well enough for both of us to go to sleep. Owing, however, to the wind keeping up its fury all night, I got up every now and then and had a look out on deck. But the night was dark and the wind howling, so I could see nothing but the breaking water on top of the large seas shining through the darkness, while the roaring noise of the breaking seas made us feel rather gloomy during that night. We were very glad when daylight made its appearance on the eastern horizon. The wind kept up its fury all the forenoon, accompanied by heavy seas and passing clouds. At midday, the sun was clear and the wind moderating, and by standing on top of the cabin deck and putting one arm round the mainmast to steady myself and watching my chance when the boat was on top of a large sea, I managed to get a good observation of the noon sun. According to that observation, our little vessel had drifted 24 miles to the southward in 16 hours while she had been hove to under the sea anchor. The wind during that gale was from the north-northwest. During the afternoon, the wind kept on lightening, the seas getting smaller, and the sky clearing, and the first gale of our long voyage was over. The Tilikum had weathered it without the least trouble, not losing as much as a rope yarn. In fact, the gale had not left a trace of any kind either on the Tilikum or her crew. The only thing the gale had done was to give us great confidence in the Tilikum's capability of carrying us to our appointed destination. During the afternoon, the wind kept on decreasing, and at 4 o'clock there was still a strong breeze blowing from the same direction as it had kept on all day. But the seas had lost their dangerous breaking tops, and therefore the danger of the same had disappeared. I hauled down the small storm sail, took in the sea anchor, hoisted the staysail, and the Tilikum swung round before the wind and sea on her southerly course. I kept her going under small sails for a while, but at midnight we were spinning along once more under all sail. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.